Many of you have asked us for a longer podcast, a full version of each Sci-Fry show. Well, we heard you, and now you can listen to each full show. No need to have to keep juggling and clicking to the next section. It will come up automatically, just like on the radio. You'll hear the billboard at the top letting you know what's coming up, should you wish to fast forward. So here we go. Hope you enjoy Science Friday. Is global warming a national security problem? The Navy is betting on it. Rear Admiral David Titley is here to tell us how the Navy is preparing to do battle with the effects of climate change in the Arctic and around the world. Plus, a new report says that half the men in the U.S., Mexico, and Brazil are infected with human papillomavirus, or HPV. Some types of that virus are known to cause cervical cancer in women, and HPV's been linked to an upswing in oral cancer. We'll find out more. Finally, physicist Brian Greene is back to talk about the nature of reality. He takes us to the place where physics meets philosophy, and we'll visit the hidden universe of his desk in this video pick of the week. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. First, a look at some new research on HPV infections, human papillomavirus. It's actually a group of viruses and more than 100 types. And some of these types, HPV-16, for example, have been linked to cancer and other diseases. HPV can cause cervical cancer, and some types of oral cancer might also be caused by a strain of HPV, which makes new research just released so disturbing. About half of the men in the U.S., Mexico, and Brazil, about half of the men are infected with some form of HPV, says a newly released paper in The Lancet. And that's what we're going to be talking about this hour. Our number was 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI. Dr. Maura Gillison is a professor and the Jed Coughlin Chair of Cancer Research at The Ohio State University in Columbus. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Gillison.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Anna Giuliano is Program Leader in Cancer Epidemiology at the H. Lee Moffitt Cancer Center and Research Institute in Tampa, Florida. We should point out that Dr. Giuliano has received grant money from the Merck Pharmaceutical Company to study HPV, and Merck, of course, makes the HPV vaccine Gardasil. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Giuliano.
Oh, thank you very much.
Dr. Gillison, let's start out with some definitions. What is HPV? It's not just one virus, right?
That's true. HPV is a group of viruses. There are approximately 100 of them that infect humans. Some of the types cause very simple things like the common wart on the hand or the plantar wart on the foot, but most of the cancer-causing types that we're talking about infect largely the genital mucosa and the oral cavity.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about these viruses that do that. Cervical cancer. There's a cervical cancer and other genital cancers in men.
That's true. There are several types that are associated with cervical cancer. The most common one is HPV-16 and
right.
HPV-18, and those are both included in the currently available HPV vaccines. HPV is associated with several cancers that occur in both men and women. In women, it's cervical cancer, vulvar, vaginal, anal cancer, and oral cancer. And in men, it's penile cancer, anal cancer, and oral cancer.
Mm-hmm. And what is the link between HPV and oral cancer? How close is that link?
Well, it was declared by the World Health Organization in 2007 that HPV-16 is a cause of oropharynx cancer. Oropharynx cancer is cancer that arises from the back of the mouth or upper part of the throat, most commonly from the tonsil. Mm-hmm. So in the HPV field and the head and neck field, it is now established as a cause.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Giuliano, you published a paper that looked at the rates of HPV infection in men, and you looked at the genital infection, correct?
That's correct. So we were actually detecting 37 different types of HPV occurring that could occur in men at the external genital skin. And we followed men prospectively so we could actually look at the rate at which men acquire these new infections and the rate at which these infections are cleared.
Mm-hmm. And is that a surprising rate, 50% of men, Mexico, Brazil, the U.S.?
Actually, it wasn't surprising. We had done some smaller studies earlier on in other parts of the United States and had found very similar prevalence estimates. And in fact, in looking at estimates from other countries around the world, you see using the same method for detecting HPV, very similar high levels of HPV prevalence mm-hmm. in men at the external genital skin. Now, but we have to remember that is a summary measure of all HPV types that were detected.
That's my question. So that doesn't say that all those HPV types cause the cancer.
Exactly. And in fact, the evidence that we have is that we can say that one type in particular, and that's HPV-16, is the cause of all of the cancers that Dr. Gillison has just listed for you that occur in men. We have very little evidence for other types of HPV causing cancer in men.
Dr. Gillison, is it possible that if you have an HPV genital infection that you can spread it or it can be spread to your mouth or to someone else's?
HPV is a very unusual virus in that it doesn't spread through the bloodstream. So you are correct that a genital infection is considered a distinct infection from an oral infection. Right now, the principal risk factor for acquiring an oral infection appears to be oral sex, but we can't exclude that you could transmit the infection finger to mouth or even mouth to mouth.
So you're saying you cannot exclude that possibility?
No, we can't right now.
Mm-hmm. Are the incidence of these cancers and the infection rates, are they going up for men and women?
Well, we know for cervical cancer, because cervical cancer screening is extraordinarily effective, that for the last several decades, incidence rates for cervical cancer have been going down in the U.S. However, there are cancers for which there is no effective or widely utilized screening program that are caused by HPV that are going up over time over the last several decades. These would include vulvar cancer, anal cancer, and oral cancer. For anal cancers, the increase is in men and women. For vulvar cancer, obviously just in women. And for oral cancers, the rate is largely increasing among men. For instance, since 2000 in the United States, there's been about a 5% increase per year among men and a 10% increase in men who are white and under the age of 60.
Is this from having multiple sexual partners?
We suspect that what is happening is that as a result of the sexual revolution, HPV infection is more common. It only takes sexual contact with one infected partner to acquire an HPV infection. However, the higher the number of partners you've had, the higher the probability that you've been exposed to someone with an infection.
Would condoms be helpful to stop the spread here?
Consistent use of condoms has been shown to reduce but not eliminate infection transmission.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the take-home message for everybody listening to this saying, what do I do? What should I do? How do I protect myself? How should I be careful? I'll ask both of you, Dr. Gillison and Dr. Giuliano.
After you, Anna.
Okay. Well, I think it's really important to reiterate what Dr. Gillison has just said about screening. We have had very effective cancer screening programs for the prevention of cervical cancer. So we know that screening can work when we have something available to screen. The problem that we have for the cancers that are affecting men that are caused by HPV is that we do not have a screening method that we can offer. So we can't prevent those cancers via screening the way we have so effectively with cervical cancer. So that leaves us with essentially primary prevention, which is how can we prevent infection with HPV? Now, you touched on one method, which is condom use. And as Dr. Gillison said, it's imperfect. We've published and others have published that you get partial protection from condoms. But condom use is important for a variety of reasons, so it's something that we would still strongly promote. The other is where there is evidence that male circumcision can reduce HPV infection, both in the male as well as transmission to the female partner. Mm-hmm. And then the third is, you know, the classic primary prevention through vaccination. And we now have in the United States a licensed vaccine against HPV that is available for both males and females.
Mm-hmm. There's a tweet that came in that says, please clarify if the HPV study made a distinction between straight and homosexual males as they have vastly different sexual habits.
And so in our publication, we assessed both sex with the same-sex partner as well as with a female.
And so it's...
And what we find is an increased risk for HPV infection, so acquiring a new infection with increasing number of partners. In the case of men who have sex with men, it's increasing number of male sexual partners. And in the case of men who have sex with women, it's higher risk with an increase in the number of female sex partners.
Mm-hmm. And then the fact that this is spreading between men and women is, does the vaccine work in boys as well as girls?
Well, I'd like to clarify something about the vaccine. We have evidence that the HPV vaccine is effective in preventing anogenital lesions in women by the HPV types that are included in the HPV vaccine. Anna just published also a beautiful paper in the New England Journal looking at the effectiveness of the vaccine in preventing largely external genital warts in boys and men. And it was also found to be about 90% effective. With regard to oral HPV and oral HPV infection and cancer, or any premalignant lesions for HPV-related head and neck cancer, we have absolutely no data. So we can't say that the vaccine has any potential utility in preventing oral infections that lead to cancer because the studies have not been done.
Mm. So you're confident of the cancers, but not the oral ones.
Correct.
Yeah. And just to reiterate my question before, because the audience I'm sure is going to be interested, are you then recommending that boys get the vaccine also?
Certainly there's a permissive recommendation that parents and pediatricians talk about vaccinating boys largely to prevent genital warts. I'm advocating actually trying to study the use of the vaccine as to whether or not it prevents oral infection.
If I can add to that, so there's FDA licensure now for several endpoints in men. So FDA has licensed a vaccine for the use of the prevention of genital warts in both males and females, as well as anal infection and anal cancer in both males and females. So we're seeing, as more research is being conducted, we're really seeing an expansion of the utility of this vaccine for both males and females. Mm-hmm. And Maura is completely correct. We need to see the efficacy of this vaccine in preventing oral infections and oral disease.
All right. We're going to have to stop it there. Thank you, doctors, for taking time to be with us.
Thank you. And I just wanted to disclose that I, as Anna, have received funding from Merck.
Okay. Thank you for that. Anna Giuliano and Maura Gillison, cancer researchers. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've talked a lot about climate change on this show and how it may be affecting our environment, weather patterns, animals, species, plants, all kinds of stuff. But we haven't talked much about how climate change impacts national security. Yeah. But the military has been talking about it, specifically the Navy. The Navy Admiralty is worried about global warming. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense given that what is happening in the Arctic, where lots of once frozen water is now open sea in the summertime. Joining me now to explain the connection is Rear Admiral David Titley. He is the oceanographer of the Navy. And he is also director of the Navy's Task Force Climate Change. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be here.
I'm interested in reading your biography and notes about you that you confess to one time being a global warming skeptic.
Yes.
What changed your mind?
What really changed my mind was when you go and look at all the evidence, I think to, at least to me, I think it really showed that the climate was changing. I was, as you might know, I was trained as a meteorologist, and you see, of course, the day-to-day and sometimes even hour-by-hour changes and variations. I watched the computer models in the 70s and the 80s, and, you know, as we all knew, you know, how many times have we all shoveled 6 inches of partly cloudy off of our driveway? So how, you know, if that was the accuracy, how well could we really say what was going on? But as I learned more about the topic, you see that really the climate is controlled not so much by what the day-to-day weather started as, but by what are the larger things doing, what are the ocean doing, what is the sun doing, and what's our atmosphere doing. So that really was able to show me. And the other part that maybe is even more important was just taking a look at all the different changes. One of my first jobs in the Navy, I was a navigator, and this is well before we had the global positioning system, so I may be one of the few guys who actually still know how to use a sextant and all that sort of thing. And we are able to, when you navigate a ship, you don't just use one source of information. You use everything you can, and I kind of look at the climate the same way. So we look at the changes in the Arctic, we look at the melting of the glaciers, we look at what's going on with the ice fields, especially in Greenland, but also West Antarctica, look at the changes of the temperature in the ocean, the changes of the ocean acidity, and all of that observations, all of that evidence, if you will, together, along with my now better understanding of what is driving the climate, has sort of taken me from the, hey, I'm not sure there's really anything here, to there really is some changes going on. And to make sure that our Navy is ready in the 21st century, we have to look at these changes just as we look at changes in the political spheres and the economic spheres and the demographic concepts. Mm.
You say in a talk that you foresee the ocean level rising 3 to 6 feet in the 21st century. That is a pretty high number, far above what the IPCC estimates. Do you have a plan for this, for a worst case scenario like that? And why is your number a little bit higher or much higher?
Well, sure. Let's talk about the number first. I testified to the Congress back in November that, you know, we in the Navy believe that the sea level rise in the 21st century is most probably going to be about a meter. So let's say a little over 3 feet. But what I told the Congress is, if I'm wrong, I'm probably wrong on the low side. And the reason for that is, and the IPCC, while they didn't have those kind of numbers, they knew there was something missing when you go read the full report. And the observations and the science since the IPCC report was released is showing us that the changes going on, especially on the Greenland ice field, but also in the Antarctic ice field, are much more rapid than have previously been seen. And you may have had on previous shows some of the either the glaciologists or the oceanographers, but talking about how the warmer water is getting up into those fjords in Greenland, melting the bottoms of these glaciers. And the best example I can think of this is if you think of like a medieval cathedral with flying buttresses, and those buttresses hold up the walls. Well, if you start taking away those buttresses or start melting the bottom of the glacier that was grounded in the fjord, all of a sudden the ice starts flowing a whole lot more faster than it had before. We're still at just the very beginnings of understanding this. I think mm-hmm. the science, it's you know, if I was 30 years younger, this would be a wonderful thing to go get a PhD in. But from a Navy perspective, a practical perspective, I think we're going to have to account for at least a meter of sea level rise in the 21st century.
Well, how do you go to a Congress who's entering freshmen in the House side? Many of them don't believe in global warming and may say to you, we don't want our tax military money spent on this silly thing.
Well, I think right now, and although that sounds, it's like this, you know, can get people's attention. Right now, the observations show that the sea level today is rising somewhere between 3 and 3.5 millimeters per year. And it turns out, and I'll bet many of your audience knows that sea level rise, somewhat like politics, is in fact, with apologies to Tip O'Neill, is all local. Because you have to understand not only what the global sea level rise is, which in itself is a huge challenge, but then there are local effects. And then in, even if the land is going up and down, makes a big difference. So our Secretary of Defense, when he signed out the Quadrennial Defense Review, which is an overarching strategic document for our Department of Defense, has directed his staff, specifically an office called the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, to do some very detailed studies of the impact of sea level rise on some of our Department of Defense installations, and including places the Navy is very interested in, like Coronado near San Diego out in California, Camp Lejeune, where we have a major Marine base, and the Norfolk, Virginia area. And those studies will probably take about 2 years or so. And I've been asked before, it's like, well, geez, can we wait 2 years? And I said, well, 2 years is about 7 millimeters of sea level rise. I think we can wait 7 millimeters to try to really understand and get the right answers, so that while we do not absolutely cannot be caught sort of with behind the changes, we also do not want to spend money too soon, or what we would call ahead of need. So we have time to get the answer. Now's the time to start acknowledging that we need to look at these studies. And the Secretary of Defense has directed those studies to happen.
And what would, if the studies verify what you're saying, and I don't think there's any reason to doubt that what you're saying about sea level rise is real, what are the first actions that the Navy would take to combat the sea level rise?
I think, Ira, that each place is likely to be different.
Give me an example. Pick a place. Tell me which is. Let's say San Diego.
Okay. For San Diego, I think, again, then the studies will need to be done. But do you build slightly increased levees? Do you take a look at that? Do you take a look at raising some of the infrastructure? Do you let's say if some of the hotel services underneath the pier, and as the water slowly comes up, do you need to say redesign those piers so that the hotel services would not flood, let's say on a storm tide? So these are all things that our engineers in our Naval Facilities Command and our Installations Command are starting to think about today. And again, while these numbers are very, very significant, we do have time. We have time to get this right.
All right, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Andy in Oklahoma. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hi there.
Great.
Thanks for taking my call. Here in Oklahoma, we have a U.S. Senator, Jim Inhofe, who seems to think that there's a lot of demagoguery and that global climate change is a hoax. And if this isn't rehashing too much, but two questions. One is, what are the maybe top three or top five pieces of evidence that converted you as a meteorologist? And secondly, do you and the Navy attribute any of the global climate change to human behavior, or are y'all kind of staying out of that fray?
Okay, well, thanks very much for the question. First, the types of evidence that at least I've looked at and I've talked with our senior Navy leadership is really the Arctic is, I think, sort of a harbinger of some of the largest examples of climate change. We have seen not only the extent of the ice in the summertime or September come down dramatically, but even more so, the total amount of ice, or how much thick ice and thin ice is up in the Arctic. And we're seeing really before our eyes a very different system now, in which just 10 or 15 years ago, there was what the scientists call multi-year ice, really thick ice, lasts for years and years. It's probably 5, 10, 15 or more feet thick. Almost all of that ice is now gone. Maybe only 15-20% at the most of the Arctic has that kind of very thick ice. And now the predominant kind of ice in the Arctic is single-gear ice. So it melts in the summer, comes back in the winter, melts in the summer again. That's a very, very different regime. And I kind of like watching ice because, I mean, ice doesn't vote. Ice doesn't contribute to any political party. It doesn't caucus. It just melts. And the ice kind of tells a story. So there's just one piece of evidence. But as I mentioned before, I look at many pieces. As to the causes of climate change, again, when you look at the physics, you know, about the only things you can really change is you can change the sun and how much energy is coming in. NASA's done a pretty good job of measuring that, and it shows that pretty much to within a couple tenths of 1%, the energy from the sun over the last 50 years has been pretty constant. Or you can change the amount of greenhouse gases. You can change the aerosols. We understand like how many volcanoes have been up. So when you put all this together, it looks like the greenhouse gases have a significant impact. The details, of course, get very, very complicated. It's not for the Navy to say what the policies are going to be or what they should be. But again, I'm interested in making sure our Navy and our Chief of Naval Operations wants to keep our Navy ready for this coming century. So we need to understand these changes to the best we can and adapt to them.
Let's go to Yonica in Central Washington.
Yeah, Ira, your program is my favorite program because you deal more with global warming than anybody else on NPR, and I love you. I also respect the Admiral, and I thank him for testifying before Congress, but I'd like to disagree with him on one point. What's your name again? Can I address you directly?
Sure, Admiral Titley.
What?
Admiral Titley.
Yes, Admiral Titley. I disagree with you on one point, and this is something that I feel on Ira's show week after week. He interviews scientists who, like myself and all my friends and everybody I know that global warming is real, who can see the floods, the fires, the droughts, the famines, and you probably know, I mean, you should know, that scarcity causes war, and that one of the effects of global warming will be increased warfare. So I disagree with you when you said, well, let's wait a few years and study it more, because what's a few millimeters? Well, you probably know that global warming has a cascading effect, that each event event doubles. let me finish, okay?
Well, let me just tell everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR.
Okay, can I go on?
But quickly, because we're running out of time.
Okay, my feeling is every scientist that you have had on has talked about more and more study. My feeling is that if every scientist who was prepared to study global warming instead studied alternative energy and conservation and what to do about it, that we would be much farther ahead, because scientific understanding never ends.
All right. Let me just get a reaction from the Admiral.
Just very quickly, Ira. One, thank you for the comment. Regarding the sea level rise, we think actually it is appropriate. And again, for the next 2 years, we see sea level rise, say, 6 or 7 millimeters. I cannot ask my boss, the Chief of Naval Operations, to go to the Congress to spend a lot of money for a 7-millimeter sea level rise. Your caller is absolutely right that some of the potential consequences of climate change can be instability because climate change can exacerbate already political instabilities, and the Quadrennial Defense Review does a very nice job of talking about that. I'll give you a couple just one example of what we are doing. We are working with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and other federal agencies to fundamentally retool our ocean and atmosphere and ice prediction systems to make them, frankly, more relevant to sort of the human scale, not just global scale, but the human scale and human time. So seasonal, decadal times, the kinds of times that families, businesses, industry, government, military actually make budgetary decisions on. And we need to do that to, frankly, have credibility. As I'm sure your audience knows, while the large-scale effects of climate change are quite easily understood, when you come down to regional and specific effects that you're actually going to budget for and mitigate against, the science is much less certain. While we're not going to have ourselves paralyzed by analysis, we do need to invest in the right amounts of understanding before we spend large amounts of our taxpayers' money. Mm.
And you agree it's going to take a long time to implement any of these changes?
The changes are not fast in almost any large organization. But I think it's very encouraging that our senior leadership, our president, our secretary of defense, our chief of naval operations, secretary of the Navy, have been very consistent that this is one of the topics, not the only topic by any means, but one of the topics that deserves serious, sustained attention.
All right, Admiral. Thank you for taking time to be with us and voice those opinions. And
thank you very much, Ira.
And good luck to you.
If anybody is still interested or is interested on what our Navy is doing, they can look us up on Facebook at Navy Task Force on Climate Change.
There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.
Rear Admiral David Titley is the oceanographer of the Navy. Do you ever think we'd have the oceanographer of the Navy on? And he is also director of the Navy's Task Force Climate Change. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to move from the climate to physics. Brian Green is back with us. He'll be back here to talk about multiverses, different universes and things, kind of interesting stuff. We'll be right back after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, physics to make your hair hurt in really a good way. You're going to want to hear about this, for example. Think about this. Is the universe we are living in the only one? What if, when you got into your car this morning to drive to work, another you in another universe got into a different car and drove to the beach instead? Seems hard to believe and maybe more like science fiction, but some theoretical physicists say we might exist in one of many universes, or in a multiverse, as they call it. So what if the universe, as we know it, is really just one of many universes? What does that tell us about the laws of physics here in the universe we know of? Can we ever test the theory of a multiverse? And ultimately, does this mean we need more than one Miss Universe pageant? Joining me now to talk about it is my guest, Brian Green, having a good laugh with me here. He's professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia. He's also author of a new book, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos, back in our New York studios. Thanks for being with us here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Do we need another Miss Universe?
I guess so. I never thought of it that way.
Well, this is a serious idea, right? It's all through your book that there could be more than one universe.
Yes, it's a strange idea because in the old days, which means like 2.5 years ago, universe meant everything, every star, every galaxy. So what would it mean to have more than one everything? But from a number of directions, our mathematical research is suggesting that what we have thought to be everything in the past, well, that may be a small part of a much grander whole that may have other realms rightly called other universes.
And where would they have originated?
Well, it depends on the proposal. Actually, in the book, I go through actually 9 different ways in which physics has come upon this idea. The simplest is perhaps there could have been more than one Big Bang. We think of the Big Bang as creating our universe, but as we have studied the Big Bang in more and more detail, the math is suggesting that the Big Bang may not have been a unique event. There may be many Big Bangs that happen at various and far-flung locations, each creating its own swelling spatial expanse, each creating a universe, our universe being the result of only one of those Big Bangs.
And you talk about 3 different kinds of universe. Oh. We don't say universe sci, I guess. Universes.
Yeah, we have definitely gone with the S as the plural.
Yeah.
There actually are these 9 versions. Mm-hmm. One is from this multiple Big Bangs. Another very simple one to think about, which aligns with your remarks about someone driving to the beach instead of going to work, arises from imagining that space goes on infinitely far. We don't know that it does, but that's an idea that people take very seriously, that it may go on forever. If it does, there's a startling conclusion that really hasn't received as much attention as I think it deserves, which is in any finite region of space, matter, particles, can only arrange themselves in finitely many different configurations. The metaphor I like to think of is a deck of cards. You shuffle the deck, the cards come out in different orders. But there are only finitely many different orders, and that means if you shuffle the deck enough times, the order of cards must repeat sooner or later.
Ah.
Similarly, in infinite space, the arrangement of the particles must repeat sooner or later, too. And look, you and me, we're just collections of particles. So is the Earth and the Sun. So if the particle arrangement repeats, then we are out there having this conversation. And to speak to your introductory remarks, it's even easier for the particle arrangement almost to repeat, but not repeat exactly. That would mean that you may be doing something else. Maybe in that other universe you have a mustache, or my name is Jonathan, or there's all sorts of crazy stuff happening out there, and that is all compatible with this idea of space going on infinitely far.
Is it possible to find any evidence of these universes at all?
That, of course, is the key question, and I should say that the book itself is not really a cheerleading book for the multiverse. It's not a multiverse manifesto. It's taking the idea seriously because a large fraction of the theoretical physics community is taking this idea seriously and looking at it from all angles and asking those kinds of difficult questions. Can you test it? And there are some ways in which this notion could be tested. For instance, in the multiple Big Bang version that gives rise to different universes, it's possible that the different universes as they expand could collide with one another. Sort of like, think of a bubble bath.
Mm-hmm.
Each of the Big Bangs gives rise to one expanding bubble in the cosmic bubble bath. Those bubbles can smash into each other. And if they did, if our universe got hit by another, had a fender bender with another universe, that would send ripples going through the cosmic microwave background radiation, heat left over from the Big Bang. And astronomers are now looking for patterns in the microwave background radiation that might suggest that we did have that encounter in the past with another universe. That'd be a very direct way of establishing that other universes are out there.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Brian Greene, author of The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes, and The Deep Laws of the Cosmos. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and talking about multiple universes here. The Large Hadron Collider is going to do powerful experiments. Any possibility of seeing evidence of multiple universes there?
Yes, absolutely. So there's a version of multiple universes that comes from string theory, and it's called the brain multiverse, B-R-A-N-E, and that comes from the word membrane, which is one of the recent realizations in string theory is that the ingredients in the theory are not just the little tiny vibrating strings that we've, for instance, spoken about in the past in this program, but the theory also has giant membranes, which may have two dimensions like a giant sheet or three dimensions, a three-dimensional membrane. Mm-hmm. We call it a three-brain. And that suggests the possibility that all we know about our universe may exist on a giant membrane. I like to think of it as a giant slice of bread. So imagine every star, every galaxy is on a giant slice of bread with other slices of bread out there, other universes, other brain universes nearby in a giant cosmic loaf. Now, to speak to your question, at the Large Hadron Collider, when protons slam against protons at very high speed, the math suggests that some of the debris created in the collisions could be ejected off of our brain, off of our universe. How would we know that? Well, the debris will take some energy with it, which means there'll be a little less energy in our detectors after the collision than before, a missing energy signature that could give evidence that we're living our lives on a brain, that there are other brains out there, that we are part of this multiverse from string theory.
And some of these particles that disappear from could be going into one of those dimensions that string theory allows for.
Precisely right. So the other universes would be displaced from us. They'd be away from us by perhaps a millimeter or less, but in another dimension. So the dimensions that we know about would be on our piece of bread. The orthogonal directions that go from one brain to another would be the extra dimensions that string theory requires. The remarkable thing is, you say, well, if they're out there, why don't we just see those other universes right nearby? And the thing is, in string theory, light, the medium by which we see, can easily travel along our brain, our universe, but it can't jump off of our brain and travel between the brain universes.
So it has to stay at the edge of the membrane.
It stays on the edge when you're thinking about the edge in those extra dimensions. But it can move all around our universe. I can see you. I can see stars. All of those are light beams that are going along our slice of bread. You try to make the light jump off our slice of bread so you can see the other universe. The light won't do it.
Oh, it just doesn't want to cooperate.
Exactly.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Brian Greene, author of The Hidden Reality. You know, we hear one of the most exciting things in astrophysics is talking about this dark energy stuff.
My pet theory, and I have absolutely no reason to substantiate anything with it, is if there's another universe someplace, could that not be attracting that? So it's an attractive force on the outside. It looks like it's a pushing force from the inside.
It's an interesting thought, and people have played with these kinds of ideas. I've never seen a version of that story that seemed convincing.
Yeah.
But people have done a version of that with dark matter that I think holds perhaps a little bit more promise. You know, we know that there's matter out there that doesn't give off light but affects us gravitationally. Could that be matter, say, on a nearby brain, a nearby slice of bread universe? Gravity can travel from one brain universe to another. Could it be responsible for the additional gravity that we know must be out there causing these stars and galaxies to move as they do, but the matter would be invisible because light doesn't travel from brain to brain? That's a proposal, too, that people have studied. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this. One of the kinds of universes that you have in there is the holographic universe. Hard to imagine for many of us.
Yes, that is in many ways the strangest proposal of all, but it is one that may have the chance of being tested in the next few years. In fact, we're doing tests right now at the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. Experiments there are actually probing this idea. And the idea is this. All that we know about in this three-dimensional world around us, this proposal suggests, may actually be a holographic-like projection of laws of physics that exist on a thin bounding surface that surrounds us. Just like an ordinary hologram, that's a piece of thin plastic. You illuminate it the right way, it creates a realistic three-dimensional image. The math of string theory and the math of black hole physics suggest that everything we know about may be a similar holographic projection of fundamental information that exists on a large surface that surrounds us. Now, you may wonder, where does this crazy idea come from?
you notice the silence.
It comes from an interesting puzzle, which comes from black holes. When you throw something into a black hole, we know it disappears. But the puzzle has been, what happens to the information that the object may contain? Let's say you throw your laptop or your iPad, whatever, you throw it into a black hole. Where does the information that that object contains go? Now, one suggestion from Stephen Hawking a long time ago is it simply disappears. The problem is that conflicts with quantum mechanics. It creates tension with quantum mechanics. So people like Leonard Susskind and Gerard de Tooft and others studied this for a long time, and they concluded that what actually happens to the information is it gets smeared out on the surface of the black hole. Uh-huh. So your iPad, whatever, it goes into the black hole, but a copy of the information is smeared out on the surface. That means that information on a bounding surface can describe a three-dimensional object that lives inside. And we believe what's true for black holes may be true for space more generally. We may be three-dimensional objects described just like your iPad going into a black hole by information on a big two-dimensional surface that surrounds us.
Do you think we'll ever know the real answer to that?
Well, this particular proposal allows us to perform certain calculations that are otherwise completely impenetrable to do with what will happen when gold nuclei slam into each other at very high speed, which is what happens at the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider out there in Long Island. Mm-hmm. The calculations are too hard to do in the traditional rote, but if you use this holographic version to translate the calculations into this bounding surface and the interior, this framework, you can do the math. The math makes predictions, and so far, the predictions are closer to the experimental data than any other approach that we have.
Wow. Talking with Brian Greene, author of The Hidden Reality on Science Friday from NPR. And joining us now is Flora Lichtman, our digital video editor, who with our video pick of the weekend, it's a special one, Flora. Why don't you introduce it?
It is a special one. Hi, Dr. Greene.
Hi there.
This week's video pick is the second in our series of desktop diaries. And in this desktop diary, we explore the hidden reality of Dr. Greene's desk.
So you it wasn't very hidden, was it,
no,
his desktop?
It wasn't very hidden. It was a very tidy workspace, yeah. Dr. Greene. Very, very tidy indeed. In fact, we have a little piece of audio from that interview.
When I was 5, 6, you know, my dad would set me these 30-digit by 30-digit multiplication problems, and I would spend the weekend doing them. You know, it's huge pieces of paper, 30-digit by 30, you know, that's a lot of writing. But to get to an answer at the end that no one had seen before was exciting. Now, look, no one had seen it before because there was no point in multiplying those numbers together. But I didn't care. It was just this big, spectacular game.
So I was curious, you know, Is there an element of this spectacular game in the kind of work that you do now?
Well, in a sense, yes, in that much of what we're discussing here, much of what I do in my day-to-day life is mathematical calculations. But there was a moment when I was growing up, older than 5 or 6, but 12 or 13 or so, when I realized, because people taught me, that math can actually describe what's out there. And that changed math for me completely. It became much more than a game. It became a gateway to try to understand what's actually out there. And that's what really thrills me about these ideas. Yes, they come from math, but time and again, we have found that the math really can explain what we see.
And it does very – your desk, we would send Florida to do your picture of your desk, and she came back with this wonderful, wonderful video showing your environs that you work in.
And one thing that was surprising to us is that you do a lot of your calculations with pencil and paper.
Yes, I do.
Sort of a throwback, it seemed
like. You know, when they get too complicated, we do turn to computers, you know, and I have good graduate students and postdocs as well, and they're great calculators. But I was worried when you were coming and doing this desktop thing, because as I told you, there's nothing on my desktop.
You didn't clean up for us?
No, I did not clean up for you. I can't stand clutter. I can't stand piles of stuff. And whenever I see it, I basically just throw the stuff away.
But that's a change. That's a recent, or maybe not recent, but...
Oh, it is a change. Yeah, when I was in college, it was completely different. In fact, there's a picture of my dorm room in the college yearbook as the most messy, most disgusting room on the Harvard campus where I was an undergraduate. But I got to a point where I got fed up with it all, and I'm very digital. I'm this or that. And now I'm Mr. Neat.
And you have multiple computers on your desk.
I do. I do. That's correct.
Does each one have a different function, or you just use them all?
No. There are some that have more powerful programs installed in them, like Mathematica, which when I do calculations that are not really amenable to pen and paper, pencil and paper, are done in those kinds of calculational environments. So some are more powerful for that sort of an undertaking.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, because you use math to sort of tell this story or follow it to these, you know, speculative stories. Do you feel like math is a creative act?
I think math is a hugely creative field because there are some very well-defined operations that you have to work within. You are, in a sense, straitjacketed by the rules of the mathematics, but within that constrained environment, it's up to you what you do with the symbols, how you go to the next step. So rather than allowing your imagination just to run freely and wild, as you can in some areas to great effect, screenwriting and writing fiction and things of that sort, here you can allow your imagination to run, but it has to run within these very strict confines. And that's why when the math says there may be other universes, you know, the things I describe in the book, we physicists sit up and take that seriously. We don't believe it until there's observational support. But when the math tells us something, we listen.
Do you think of yourself as the Stephen Hawking of our time?
No. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, genius upon genius. And, you know, I try to make my contributions, however small they may be. But it's just exciting to be part of what I consider a species-wide quest that we have been on for 2,500 years to understand reality better.
And if you want to understand Brian Greene's reality better, I suggest you pick up a copy of his book, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes, and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos, explains all these different things we've been talking about. And also see our video pick of the week up there on our website. It's Brian's desk joining some other great real estate.
Go
up
right
there.
Into Brian's office right and see there. Where the magic happens.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And good luck with the book. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
We'll be signing you to the next desk as it comes up.
Can't wait.
I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.